Hello and welcome to episode 57 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we're talking about hidden traitor games, the intersection between social deduction and co-op games. Hidden traitor games can offer a little bit for everyone. We'll take a look at some of our favourites and dig deeper into the potential future of these games. But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, George Gia and Adam Harrison. And a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well.
Thanks, Josh. So I got something in the mail today.
Ooh.
I know.
Now, to be fair, we're getting married. Sydney and I are getting married in 4 weeks from when you guys are listening to this episode. 4 weeks.
Okay.
So we're getting a lot of like Bed Bath & Beyond boxes.
A lot of boxes.
And it's very appreciated. And today we came home from Grand Con, and there were a bunch of Bed Bath & Beyond boxes and two other boxes from CMON, which were huge, like bigger than the...
Huge!
Like vacuum cleaner size boxes. And I'm like, what is this? I didn't order anything from... Wait a minute. So I pulled them up here. Massive Darkness has been delivered.
Massive Darkness.
Exactly. It's way more space than Gloomhaven. I think there's a lot more air. It's definitely lighter. It's not as dense. But Massive Darkness, if you haven't been paying attention, that's our current giveaway. You're going to have the base box. You're going to have, I think it's the Lightbringer pledge.
Yeah.
So that adds another campaign, a whole bunch more minis. There's the Troglodytes expansion, and then two other Kickstarter exclusive figures that come along with it as well. Or like, I think... monster expansions or hero expansions.
You pulled most of it out of the box and it looks insane. The art's so cool. There's so much stuff. I was just like, whoa.
Yeah, geez. I don't know the exact count of the minis, but I would say probably between 150 to 200 minis in the box.
It's crazy.
I'd say that's fair.
Yeah. So
the little expansion you pulled out had 50 easy in there.
Yeah. So my pledge, I got the same exact thing, but I also added all the add-ons. For reasons unknown at the time, I just, I can buy more. I'm going to buy more. So I did. I need a designated house for this. So I might have to buy another house. So
wow.
Just saying. Anyway, Massive Darkness is here. How do you enter? Simple. You email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com and say September giveaway. And you can throw something in the body if you want to. Some people just put September giveaway. Period. And I'm like, that's totally fine. Add you to the list. Good to go. But that is, we're going to announce that on our October 3rd show, but the deadline is September 29th to enter. So enter now, because this box is huge.
I don't think I've even asked what kind of game it is.
It is a co-op dungeon crawl.
Okay.
So we just did an episode again on co-ops and solo games. This is one of those types of games, and it's very dungeon crawly. You pick a character class, you have abilities, you can level up, there's character progression, there's a scenario campaign based.
Yeah, it's campaign style, so it's, you know, kind of crossing that line of legacy versus straight up co-op game.
Yep.
It's Gloomhaven kind of walks that same line.
Yep. Mm. It's kind of... I haven't played it yet, but in my mind, it's kind of Arcadia Quest meets Zombicide. So you have these boards, like player boards that you're powering, that you're using to power up with, but it's a full co-op. So you're not fighting each other, but you still build a team. So each of you play one character and kind of go through. But I think the single player, I'd definitely play like two or three characters because that'd be more fun. So, and maybe that is. Like I said, I haven't even read the rules yet.
Just started looking at the pieces.
Yeah. And we've been packing all day today, so I can't unpack any more boxes. I pulled it out, I rearranged it, I put it right back in the box, and it's like, okay, 2 weeks we're moving, can't pull this out just yet. But as soon as we do, I will let you know. Let's see. So that's Massive Darkness. Conventions. Gamehole Con is just around the corner. Let's see.
In two months.
Well, it feels just around the corner for me.
Yeah.
So it's 2 weeks from now, we move into a new house. 2 weeks after that, I get on a cruise to get married. 2 weeks after that, I have the Chicago reception. And the week after that is Gamehole Con. So for me, it's just around the corner. Josh has good news, but mostly bad news for us.
Oh, yeah. I can't make Gamehole Con, which is really sucks. But my brother from Australia is making a visit home to the UK. So it's the perfect time to see everyone in one place.
Yeah. So Josh let us know that he's going to skip out on us, which leaves an opening. So if you're going to be in GameHoleCon and you're interested in helping us out on Friday, teaching a few games, send us an email. Let me know. And I can arrange for the badge. I just need someone to help sit tables or teach games. So if you're interested in doing that, shoot us an email and we'll set something up. So first person, first dibs. If I get like 20 emails, I will pick one of you. I won't play favorites, but
we'll put him in a hat, draw a name.
Exactly.
Something like that.
A whole new contest. But I don't expect that 20 people are going to respond. So
that would be really cool, though.
It would be.
I would feel so popular.
I know. But if you are able to be there, this is Madison, Wisconsin, first weekend in November. If you are able to be there and you want to help out, shoot us an email and we will get you all set up. Kickstarters. This one was, I literally just clicked the buy button. And this was from a suggestion from Michael Knight. Actually, we'll read his email in a bit, but give you more description to this. But the Islands of El Dorado is this week's Kickstarter that I backed. Not that I just backed one. It's just that I've been so busy that I'm like, oh, I'm going to take a look at this one. There's actually another one, too, from the BGG threads on, I believe, a couple weeks ago. Thread, but someone called to my attention Wanderer, the Cult of Barnacle Bay. I have not backed this one yet, but I've been looking at it, and I'm probably going to Yeah, I'm probably going to tell you that this is the one I'm backing next week, because there's so I'm almost tempted to just click the back button right now, and there's only... Well, there's two pledges. There's the $90... Actually, no, there's just one pledge. There's the $90 pledge for this... I'm going back and forth. So the one I haven't backed, Wanderer, the Cult of Barnacle Bay, which you'll hear about more next week, I'm going to back for $90. But I have not backed that yet. First, we're going to talk about the Islands of El Dorado, which is about 5 days left as you listen to this. It is fully funded. It's $156,000 of $27,000 as of Sunday. You guys are hearing this on Tuesday, probably. It's actually not a bad price for what you get. It's only $50, $49 technically. The game seems interesting in that it's not, I can't put it in any category, and neither do they. Their description of this is a strategic board game, explore the island, gather resources, and cross swords as you race to control powerful shrines. So it's an exploration game with resource gathering, with combat, it's a race, and you're trying to collect shrines. So there's a lot going on.
It sounds a little Scythe-like.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
Well, it also...
But it looks like a tile lay.
It's tile laying.
Which I love.
Yep. So it's hexagon tiles. And the hexagon tiles look a little bit like Catan tiles.
Yeah.
So
they're
different terrain types.
Terra Mystica does the same kind of thing.
Terra Mystica. Yeah. But so it's basically tile-based. And each time you move, you're exploring. So you draw a tile and you lay down the tile. What makes it different? They say it's a mix of different genres, inspired by many games. Gameplay feels familiar, but plays unlike any other. It has been categorized as a Euro 4X civilization war and race game, but it's not exclusively any of those.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
You know what it reminds me of? We were just talking about this because Spencer started playing some classic video game, but it reminds me a little bit of Heroes of Might and Magic. If anyone ever played that on the computer.
Yep, I could see that, because you're fighting around, you're trying to gather resources.
You have your hero exploring. With your army, you're gathering your resources at your base. Maybe, I don't know if there's a base, but you know, that's how Heroes of Might and Magic worked. But and I was just thinking, there's not a lot like that. You hear a lot about these 4X space games all the time, but you don't get the 4X fantasy where you're exploring a map or building a map.
I'm not sure if it's fantasy. I think it's like alternate history. Yeah, because they have their heroes are things like, I guess they're not truly, at least I don't think they're real names, but like Pedro the Conquistador and Stella the Adventurer. Conquistador, that's what I meant. Tzak the Gatherer, Hector the Corporal. I said that slower than I should have.
If you talk fast, nobody knows you're mispronouncing things.
Exactly. Victoria the Wealthy, Lafayette the Pirate, Jane the Cartographer, Nicholas the Fortress, and there's more. I don't want to spoil them all to you.
No Julio and Miguel?
No, no, not yet. Maybe it's a stretch goal.
I hope so.
But yeah, these are some of the actions you can take. Gather, move, buy, attack, control shrines, search the cave, and win. That's an action, too. Apparently, you win when you have all four shrines. The first explorer to control all four shrines is the winner. So that is my Kickstarter game of this week. And like I say, I'm not gonna look over at Wanderer yet, but I'm probably gonna back it by the time we're done recording. So I got a bunch of Kickstarters in. I played a couple of them. Unfortunately, I played so many games this weekend, they're all slipping my mind, but it's starting to be like just so many Kickstarters are rolling in that I need to like, okay, we need to play this. So Sector 6 is, I just recalled what it was. Small box game, smaller than I thought. I definitely backed it while we've been doing the podcast, so sometime in the last year. You're prisoners. You have two prisoners, and you're running around the space station collecting oxygen. And so each different section has an oxygen tank that's worth 1 to 5 points. And once all the oxygen is gathered, game ends. You count your number of points, see who wins. The interesting thing about it, though, is it's also a hex-laying game. You can build maps. But as you move, when you leave one of the hexes, you can take an action on that hex that you just left, which is either gather its oxygen or rotate it. And if you rotate it and its gear side touches another gear side, that all the hexes that have those gears joined also rotate, but they rotate in the opposite direction. So it's very cerebral, and like it's an IQ test of like, okay, spatial reasoning. If I turn this, this happens here.
This reminds me of a challenge we had in Time Stories.
Yes.
We're trying to make a maze work.
Yep. And you couldn't touch anything until you knew exactly what you needed to do.
Yeah, and you're staring at it like,
Yeah, so it's an interesting game. Actually, so Game Hole Con, I'll kind of circle this in and end this segment before we get into feedback. Sydney and I were at Grand Con this weekend in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and we had just gotten done playing this, and Tom Vassell walks over to us, and he's like, oh, you know, did you guys just finish? You just start? Like, we just finished, and he's like, what did you think about it? I'm like, it's a really interesting game. And he's like, it's funny how that's a lot of game reviews these days. But I really did like it, and I think I would play it. I definitely would play it again. There's a number of variants that make it a little less spatial reasoning. Like you can turn off the gears or you can just turn off any kind of rotation whatsoever. So it's just a straight movement. But there's a lot in this small box. So I really do like it.
Didn't you also have some other sort of Tom Vassell anecdote where you joined a game last minute with him? Was that the same thing?
I do. But that game, coincidentally, because we always announce our shows, our topics a week before. So we announced the topic. I went to Grand Con. And then the game that Tom invited us to go play with him was a Hidden Traitor game.
Okay.
Now so I'm going to loop that all in.
We'll wait for on
leave
topic.
That for on topic. I see. But let's get into feedback. Otherwise, we'll never get on topic.
Indeed. Well, let's get into some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. So the first one is from Magnus. He says, I'm listening to your latest episode right now, and I thought I'd use the time for some reactions. First of all, best wishes to Kitty and Spencer on their future third player. Also, a late happy birthday to Kitty. I hope everything goes well, but don't take too much time off from the podcast. Let's face it, the guys need you, Kitty.
That's true.
Thank you. It is very true.
It is extremely true. Second, I'm from Germany and may try to go to Essen next year. Therefore, Chris, when you know more about your plans, it would be nice if you share them on the podcast, similar to the last few conventions. I'm originally from the area, but never realized how big a deal it is internationally. Especially, I just realized about a year ago that the Spiel des Jahres, All Men Must Die, Arya Stark, is an award that is followed internationally. Finally, I'm thinking about my second game to kickstart after Gloomhaven. I found two I find interesting, but just have the budget for one. Now, I can't decide and would appreciate any feedback. The Island of El Dorado or Vastly Wilds, the card-based board game.
So I think I gave Michael Knight the credit for this. Also, Michael Knight, I want to know if that's actually your real name. And if it is, I just want to know you have a card named Kit. But you have to be old, I guess.
I understand.
Reference.
Yeah. But Magnus, I went with Island of El Dorado. I looked at both. Vastly Wilds, a card-based board game. The art looked really cool. It's a cheaper price tag. It's actually kind of an interesting concept because the cards don't, they're not like a grid that you would lay down. There's different, so you lay down a card and then there's like a kind of a card at an angle cut out that you can lay another card on. So as you lay down all the cards, they kind of spread themselves out in like a tree kind of map.
Interesting.
So it made for an interesting like forest creation thing. But Magnus told me I had to pick one. So I picked Eldorado. And that one I actually picked because I'm not normally alternate history art style, but I'm like, I'm going to do this anyway because I need to broaden my horizons.
It looks totally up my alley.
I figured like, yeah, Kitty will like this. So that's why I picked that.
Looks very Lost Expedition, City of Zed kind of thing going on.
Yeah, and if you went Gloomhaven to this one, you're probably going to get a lot less for half the money. So you'll probably get like a tenth of the game for half the money. But that's what typically is. Gloomhaven's just...
Gloomhaven is massive and crazy.
Yeah.
And a really good price.
Yeah, for $100. Yeah, it's insane. All right, next.
All right, from David Radke. This is David Radke. You may recognize me as one of your new patrons. Or by last week's episode, which featured a classic mispronunciation of my name. Josh, totally butchered it on your first attempt. But Chris got it right. It is pronounced Radke. Don't worry about it. Everyone gets it wrong the first time. Keep up the good work.
So normally I wouldn't put this email on air, but I just got to make Josh say Spiel des Jahres again. Which was fun.
I saw it in the notes and my heart sank.
And I said Radke like how many times here?
Exactly. And anytime someone says Josh totally butchered it and Chris got it right, it's an instant. In fact, if you send me an email just says Josh butchered it, Chris got it right, I'm probably gonna put it on the show.
Classic. All right, Chris.
Let's actually go to Michael Knight now.
Indeed. Well, Michael Knight, he says, I just listened to your episode on gaming tables. My friend just spent thousands of dollars on a custom-made table. It's very nice and has retractable cup holders as well as a one-piece top that turns it into a dining table. It does take some time getting used to the 3-inch well. Since he now has a nice gaming table, we usually play at his house, so my desire for a gaming table has been satiated by him. Over 10 years ago, I wanted a Surface for gaming. I was playing several games with my kids, such as HeroScape and other board and miniature games, so I cut a piece of plywood to 3 feet by 4 feet. My wife bought a piece of green felt and wrapped it completely around the board, securing it with glue and staples. When we were done, we could slide it behind the piano and just board it out when we were gaming. It worked great for many years until my twins were using it as a ramp and jumped on it and it cracked. Wow. That was a great table topper that was quite inexpensive, but without any features such as cup holders. I really enjoy listening each week. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Michael. I actually like this idea, and I think it's such an easy way to make a game, a tabletop for pretty much any size table.
Yes.
So, and felt is incredibly cheap. You go to Michael's or Joann Fabric, very inexpensive. And you can just buy yards of it for like $2 a yard. And go online, get a coupon, you'll get half off of that.
Yeah. Download the Joann Fabrics app because it's amazing.
Yeah. Did I mention this on air? I don't think so. I was just talking to you guys. But we are doing a whole bunch of wedding reception stuff. And so we're going and making our own tablecloths and all of that. And I'm getting all this cloth measured because we're doing like Harry Potter, like banquet style tables. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting 4 different colors of cloth and all of that. And it's not cheap to get, you know, 8 yards of different fabrics. So I'm talking to the girl who's cutting the cloth. She's like, do you have the coupons? I'm like, coupons? What? She's like, oh no, you need to go to the website, get this. Also download the app and get those coupons. I walked out saving $240 between the website and the app. It would have been normally like something like $560 and I saved like $240 off of it.
Yeah. Wow. Always have the app. I'm actually sewing flower girl dresses for my sister's wedding right now. So
yeah,
so doing the same thing.
Yeah, looping it back around. Also, you can use those coupons with your felt. The top of your custom table topper.
You could also check out, they've got all kinds of fun and fancy fabrics, patterns and stuff there.
Yep.
Maybe some of the like thicker spandex might give you kind of like the neoprene feel.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yep. So, and you can make multiple pieces, multiple sections too, and if you had a bigger table or you just wanted to have a half table or something like that.
Yeah.
So, all kinds of DIY stuff. Let's see. From Grant Lovett. So this one actually came in, I think, last week. Hi, all. Thanks for the giveaway. I really enjoy the podcast. You mentioned Headhunters going to Kickstarter. I first heard about it last year on a podcast, not ours. It did kickstart in June, but was canceled due to lack of interest. Is it going to be relaunched, a Kickstarter campaign? Yes, it's absolutely going to be relaunched. One of the reasons it was canceled was just kind of a separation between art and strategic depth. So they weren't quite hitting the audience they were looking for. So the interest wasn't building there. I really do hope this one backs because in case, just to remind you, Headhunters, which I didn't use the right name at the time, they're figures that are about maybe 6 inches tall and they have big hexagon heads. And if you open up their hexagon heads, there's cards inside of them along with a measuring tape and some placement pieces. And it's a tabletop miniature game that you take these things and you run them around the board. But because everything fits in their head, they looked a little cartoonish. So they're kind of like, you know, toughening up the art, if that's a thing. And they're going to re-release later this year is their current plan. So, but Grant goes on. For Chris, in episode 46, which was our yard game episode, you mentioned how much you enjoyed lawn darts, jarts, and how you wish you had a set. I have a new in-box set of jarts and would like to send them to you. And he did. So,
and they're here on the table in all of their terrifying glory.
These are amazing. So Grant sent me, like, literally this box is from the 70s, I believe, maybe early 80s. But it's as if they were never removed from the box. Probably rightfully so.
Yeah.
To be completely fair. I am going to remove these and play these when I move in.
I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to this because you told me about how scary and dangerous these could be, but they just look so cool. Oh, man.
I'm going to really enjoy watching you guys play from a safe distance.
Yeah, they're giant metal darts, just like you would throw at a dartboard, but giant. And you throw them up in the air and they come down and sink about 2-3 inches into the ground
like
when they
small,
hit.
Like small game or something if you were hunting in the wild.
You could probably hunt small you game could with them.
Definitely yeah. take yep. out a squirrel.
Yep. Sweet. But you put these rings. So there's a blue ring and a red ring and you put them on both sides of the lawn. It's not like bags or horseshoes where you throw them at each other. All of you are on one side or the other.
That's good.
So that's you have to walk from one end to the other. But
you just have to worry about neighbors wandering in from the other yard accidentally.
Yeah. Otherwise, sirens start going off and ambulances start showing up and it's just not good.
It's just like you live in the city of Chicago.
So I would have posted a picture of this on Twitter. There's a couple things that are amazing about this box. On the side, Jarts, missile game. It literally says the missile game. And it has a patent number. So they're patented. The most exciting outdoor game today. And at the bottom of the front of the box is an outdoor game for the family.
Toss like horseshoes. They stand up in the ground.
Yes. So check out the Twitter feed if you want to see that. It'll be on Game Master Chris or Tabletop Game TLK. So either one of those Twitter feeds, you're going to see a picture of these. And Kitty will probably put it on her Instagram too.
Yeah.
Which is, how do I find that?
On Instagram,
yeah.
We are at Tabletop Game Talk.
Awesome.
Super easy.
Okay.
So to a quick question from one of our listeners, this is a question that won't fill an entire show topic, but we think is interesting nonetheless. Today's question comes from Sam. What games that you absolutely loved did not have a long shelf life? I got a copy of Photosynthesis thanks to a friend of mine who was able to attend Gen Con. I was totally into it when I first opened it, but can already see the novelty of it is wearing off. It seems like Chris's glowing adulation for Not Alone from earlier episodes has already diminished considerably. Are there any other previously favorite games that have also hit potential giveaway pile?
Almost everything, because I'm cult of the new.
I'm not as bad as you. Like, it has to become like a real favorite to like linger in my collection or for it to move from your collection quietly into mine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of games where when I first play them, like, I really enjoyed that game, and then something else hits the table, and I'm like, oh, I really enjoyed that game, too. I like a lot of kinds of games. I agree with you with Photosynthesis. I've only played it once. I really liked it, and I would love to play it again. It's in my keep side, but I haven't pulled it out because there's so many other new stuff coming in. So I think I'm kind of an exception to that more than anything else.
I might put Century Spice Road in this category of I played it a few times and it's probably going to, you know, I would keep it in my collection maybe, but like it wouldn't be a game that I play like oh, it's like, you know, people I game with a lot. Like, that would be like an intro game for people who I don't game with frequently.
Yeah. Dresden Files, the card game. We bought this and I bought all the expansions. And the first time we played it, we just like rapid fired played through every scenario that comes in the base box. But it hasn't hit the table since. Because, you know, it was just the right time, right place. We had the right group of people, and we played it and really enjoyed it. But now if I'm looking for a game, I'm not necessarily pulling that one off the shelf. So those kind of games, I think it happens quite frequently for me. What about you, Josh? Is there anything?
Well, I mean, I'm going to almost cheat this question because the game is Letter Tycoon, and the game is brilliant, and I was really happy to get Gloria into some sort of board game because she's not really a gamer, but she loves Scrabble, and this has got a bit more strategy to it, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to be able to compete here. Normally I don't want to play Scrabble because she'll crush me, but I was like, in this I can compete and we'll play a game together. And so we played a few times and she crushes me every time, despite me having the little bit of strategy in there. So the only reason it's worn off for me, and only for me, she loves it, she still wants to play it, is because I'm not going to win.
Yeah. And that can do it. I mean, that can actually completely affect. Like, I really liked this game until I realized I was really not good at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think Sydney has been in that situation a few times as well, where, you know, she'll really like something and then she may lose several times in a row. And even though she's definitely getting better, she'll be like, yeah, I'm not really in the mood to play that game right now. So, which I completely understand. And that's why you switch to something else. And then for her, I can get her to go back to it after there's been enough time.
I think I got that way with Terra Mystica a little bit. I lost too many times in a row. And I didn't have the energy to put into the strategies that the people I was playing against did. And
so we have a request outstanding to do an episode on deep strategy games, so we're going to do that in a future episode, and I'll read that email at that time. But I need to get you guys to play some deep strategy games in the meantime, which are tricky. So these are games that are...
It's a loose definition, I feel like.
So I'm going to define it as essentially a pure non-random game. Okay. So Terra Mystica is a pure non-random. There's no rolling dice. You make choices. It's almost true Euro in that regard, where there is no randomness involved. There's no cards you're drawing. There's really nothing besides the scoring mechanism, and that just kind of drives your strategy. So that's what I'm going to define it as. Something that's like really more tactically minded versus
luck-minded. I'm excited.
So we have to play a few of them because that's our new policy. So we have to play at least three so that we can talk about them and compare and contrast, which is what we did today. So let's get into that, shall we?
In this episode, we're talking about hidden traitor games. Not exactly social deduction games, not all co-op, but something in the middle. Are they the solution to the alpha player? Are they a way to add mechanics to social deduction? Are they a trend we want to see more of? Let's find out.
So I will go on record of saying I think I really love these games. I may think I enjoy them more than I do. So I'm just going to start the conversation like that.
You think you might enjoy them more than you actually do enjoy them.
Right. You know how sometimes you're like, I really like chocolate ice cream, but every time I try chocolate ice cream, it's like, it's not that great.
It's good, but I'm not sure. Maybe I wanted mango. Yeah. I don't know.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, I really enjoyed the ones we played recently were my first ever hidden traitor games. And I felt like I got the emotional roller coaster that I get out of social deduction, but there was still a game to be played there. And I quite liked that hybrid because it's like sometimes with social deduction, it feels it's all about accusing and all about, you know, kind of throwing these accusations left and right. But at least if you've got the mechanics of the game involved, then I'm feeling like, well, okay, even if they think I'm evil, we can still play this. We can still move forward and make decisions.
I'm going to start by throwing out classic hidden traitor. I'd say everyone knows this one is Battlestar Galactica, the board game.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
So much fun. I would say this is one of my top games that I always forget exists because it's hard to get enough people to play it. I think it plays best at 5 and 6.
Probably 5. It's best if you have an odd number, because then if you have an even number, that's you need true. A sympathizer.
Yeah.
Which is a little trickier.
Like, you want, like, exactly five people to play this game. So it's a little tricky to get that many people to sit down sometimes. We had to get the three of us plus Spencer and Sydney to play this one. But it's really fun. And what I think is I like it because you... So in social deduction games, when you figure out who the traitor is, that's it.
Yep.
With this one, you can figure out who the traitor is, but there's still stuff to be done. And they can still do their thing, but you still have your moves to make. And I don't know, I don't think I've ever been the traitor, now that I'm sitting here thinking about it. I have only ever been the good guy.
Just in that one game?
Or no, I think ever? in any Hidden Traitor game, I'm not sure I ever played the traitor.
So let's, Battlestar Galactica, if you haven't played it, just a quick overview. If you haven't seen the show...
you should watch it because it's amazing.
The first two seasons are really amazing. Great. Yeah. But the game follows the show really, really well in a lot of ways. Like, you know, I say modern IP games, like games based on TV shows or movie licenses or something, especially if Fantasy Flight's doing it, are really good games. But what happens in Battlestar Galactica is there are a number of loyalty cards equal to the number of players times two. So we had five players, so we had 10 loyalty cards. In those 10 loyalty cards, two of them said, you're a Cylon, therefore the traitor. All of those are shuffled together, and at the beginning of the game, everybody gets a card. You may have passed out both Cylon cards at the beginning. You may have passed out none, or maybe you passed out one, which is great. The game itself plays as a co-op game. You are trying to get Battlestar Galactica to Cobol. For the first one. Once you get expansions, you can actually start going different places. But that's your goal. As a group, you're trying to manage fuel, food, population, and morale. And if any of those hit zero, you lose. So you're attempting to go there. There's an admiral, there's a president. The admiral and president both have special roles. They do certain things. And then...
You have a player character that gives you special powers that apply to kind of either combat or... helping with moving these crisis cards and moving the jump forward.
Yeah. Basically, every turn you get a crisis card you're going to deal with. And you have a number, there's five different skills in the game, purple, yellow, red, green, blue, something like that. And when you need a skill test, it'll tell you what colors qualify as positive. And then you go around, you secretly place your little mini cards into the pile. If it matches the color, it goes up. If it doesn't match the color, it subtracts its value away from the test. If you meet the test, great. You succeeded at it. If you didn't, oh, somebody was probably a traitor. Except there's also two random cards from the Destiny deck that could be good or bad. So you never really know if there's a traitor or not.
Unless there's three bad cards.
Then you know there was a traitor for sure.
There was a traitor, a Cylon in your midst.
Yes. Now, halfway through, the other five loyalty cards are dealt out. In the series, there were Cylons that didn't know they were Cylons until a decent amount into the series. So this like captures that, and suddenly you may not have been a Cylon, but you are now.
Yep.
So now there could be an additional Cylon. If there was one at this round, it could be one at the second time. Or the same person could got the Cylon card at the same time, so maybe there's only one Cylon. Or now there's two new Cylons, because in the first round there were none, which was the case for our particular game.
Yes.
So that's the game. And every time it's guaranteed that's going to be a traitor, you just don't know when. And you're not sure if it's one or two, depending on the number of players.
It's usually two. I think I played this maybe three or four times. Mm-hmm. And most times it was one person in the first round and then a second person joined them in the second round is how the cards played.
Yeah. Statistically speaking, it's a decent chance that happens.
But, I mean, in our game, you know, we got the feeling that there was no traitors in the beginning. We were like, oh, everything's going really well, really smoothly. We think no one's a traitor right now. Then the next cards come out, okay, there's going to be some traitors. Yes, some bad things are happening. But the thing was, is that Sydney had a special power where she could search someone's loyalty. And she searched one person and she looked at it and said, yep, they're good. We were like, cool, okay, those two people are probably good. We don't know for sure, but...
No, they were the Cylons.
They were both evil.
They were both Cylons.
And you were...
And it took me longer because I thought she only looked at one loyalty card, but she had looked at both. And if I had remembered that, I would have known earlier that she was bad too. But I thought she saw, because I knew Chris was a Cylon. Chris is always a Cylon.
Man, the thing is, texts by cards.
Yeah.
But like, Chris and Sydney are so good at social deduction games. Like, they're so good at lying and pretending to be bad. Sydney will throw out things like, when she's evil, being like, oh, I'm surprised that no one's come out yet as the evil person. And she's the evil person. And it's such a good little line. Like, it's like, oh man, you're so good at this.
I think she's so used to, though, playing social deduction games that sometimes she gets caught up in the mechanics of a hidden traitor game. Because I got her to do something that let us win the game because she didn't want to, at that exact moment, come out as the traitor. Because that's not what you would do in a social deduction situation. She wanted to keep it going until it was to her greatest advantage to do it.
Yeah.
But... yeah.
That was good. You literally like, you are going to fix the engines, right, Sydney? And then she was like really pressured into doing it. That was genius.
So one of the reasons, like, you can force a jump and all you guys needed to do was get that jump to happen. But the FTL controls were down.
Yep.
And she had the ability to fix it. And she did to try to build trust. But it was a little late in the game. So I'm not 100% sure. I've kind of played it back and forth. I don't think she lost us the game. I don't think we would have won anyway, because you would have had two turns to be able to repair it and jump. But
everyone was in the break but me.
Exactly.
It was really tricky. And I don't know. But it's really fun. And it's one of those games where, seriously, we played this how many days ago and we still remember all these details about it. You know,
it was such a roller coaster of emotions.
It draws you into the story of the game. You're really like, you want to know what's going to happen. Are we going to make it? What's going to cost it for us? You know, we were so low on food, and I remember still that it was food that was going to kill us. And it's a really fun game.
Oh, it's amazing. And the thing that really riled me up as well is that Chris managed to convince Spencer that I was evil. Like Spencer was so convinced I was evil. And I was like shouting, being like, I'm not a Cylon. And oh man, that's the thing I love about, you know, social deduction e-games, is that it really does take you on that journey. And I love that interaction between the players. But man, I was so mad that he really thought it was me. I was like, oh, he's got to be the traitor. And you just had us played off against each other, you evil person, Chris.
Well, Terrence actually posted on BGG that he doesn't like BSG or Dead of Winter, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, it sort of makes sense. I can see how when you're playing a cooperative game, you want to be cooperating with the people you're playing with. And when you have that hidden traitor mechanic, you're no longer really playing a cooperative game. You're playing something
that
looks...
has been broken.
Right. It looks like a cooperative game. Like, that's the premise. But it's not really that anymore.
But it made it so much more interesting in my mind. I mean, it's definitely, you know, a very subjective thing and opinion-based, and I completely understand. But for me, it was like, now this is harder, and the tension has been ratcheted up so much because we're failing things left and right. We're really having to dig in and throw everything to succeed this because we've got people working against us. And that was really exciting for me, and just like, tension. Oh, loved it.
Well, and the other part of it, too, is if there's no Cylons at the beginning, so there were five of us, we were all pretty much positive there were no Cylons. There wasn't a single Cylon-y thing that happened, which would have been a great Cylon move, to be honest.
Yeah.
But we were pretty certain that everyone was safe.
I'm not sure it would have been a great Cylon move because we had set ourselves up so well in that first half. It was really hard for the people who came out, who got Cylon cards in the second round, to really sabotage it, because we were moving forward with such good pace.
Right. But what you have to do, though, since you don't know if you're going to be a Cylon or not, in the beginning, you have to be a little careful to not help too much.
Yeah.
You just want to get to the point where it's like, okay, we're four steps in. Let's go ahead and draw those next cards. So, Josh, you were playing the Admiral.
Right.
And you drew the two cards, and you could decide how far are we going, how much space are we going forward. I think you jumped us to five. So you went from two, and you played a three, which jumped us to five, which jumped us one step further than what the minimum was four to get the Cylon card. Now, it worked in your favor because you ended up not being a Cylon. Had you been a Cylon, it would have been way better to just jump to four.
Right.
So those are the kind of odds you're playing at the first half where it's like, well, I could actually be on the wrong side right now. So right. How much do I want to help? Right.
See, I like to play it as if I am the character on the show because they really have no idea.
Yeah.
And really, if you're being, you know, true to the spirit of the game, and you are helping as much as you can. Yep. And I think we all really did that.
Oh, yeah. And we all were. And that's what we were doing. So I just think it's... Terrence mentioned, well, it was mentioned about Dead of Winter. Dead of Winter has a lot going on to pick up in one game playthrough. And BSG just took too long to lose once we all fell behind whenever I played it. Now, I will say BSG plays a lot longer than we were hoping it did. It was actually a really late night.
It's true.
It's a long game, but at no point were we ever disinterested in everything that was going on.
Yeah.
I lost time. Like, we sat down to play, and I was like, okay. And then, I looked at the clock when we were finished, and I was like, oh my gosh, it is so past my bedtime. Yeah.
So, we need to play with Kitty as a trader. Now, speaking of a game, so BSG always has a trader.
Yes.
Sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes as a sympathizer, all depending on the number of players. Dead of Winter... So just to give, if you haven't played Dead of Winter, and I assume, even though these games are very popular, been around for a while, I assume that not everyone has played these games. So I'm going to just explain it real quick. Dead of Winter is you are playing survivors in a zombie apocalypse. You start out with two survivors, and you're going to go around to different places in this town. There's a hospital, a gas station, a school, police station, those types of things. And you're going to collect resources such as food, tools, gas, weapons, those types of stuff. So on your turn, you have a certain number of actions based on the number of survivors that you're controlling, and you move around and you draw cards and, okay, I got some food so I can contribute to the base and I can help feed all the survivors that's going on there. And you can play those down there. Every turn, there's going to be a crisis card that comes up that says, for this round, you must get 3 fuel on this crisis card or this horrible thing is going to happen.
That's a really easy one, actually.
Well, if it's 3 players.
Okay.
So you need X number of things for per X number of players. We were playing a 5-player game. Dead of Winter does not play well at 5.
Ew,
just simply because
so long.
It's a really, really long game. I think 3 is ideal there because you can play pretty fast and you still got that hidden traitor thing there. When you're trying to satisfy the crisis, though, you're playing cards face down. Very similar to Battlestar where you're playing the skill cards face down.
It's actually almost the same mechanic.
Right. Except there's no random card.
That's true.
Yep.
Now, they're all played by players.
Yep. Now, if we're trying to collect 3 fuel, for every fuel that counts, every fuel card that counts as 1 fuel towards the goal, for every non-fuel, that subtracts 1 from the goal. So that's how the trader can get in there. The trader in Dead of Winter, same deck of cards. So if there's 5 of us, we're going to have 10 cards, but only one of them is going to be a trader. And then those are dealt out. 1 to each player, and then the rest of them are just removed. So there's only not even a 50% chance that there is a traitor. However, everyone still has personal goals. So at the end of the game, I must have 3 fuel and 2 food in my hand, and I must have achieved the main objective in order to win the game. So even though I could potentially satisfy this crisis by putting fuel down, I don't necessarily want to if it's not that bad because it may lose my win condition if I don't have enough fuel at the end of the game. So that's how Dead of Winter sort of makes everyone look like a traitor because everyone has a little bit of a selfish win condition that's different than everyone else's.
Yeah.
Now, when we played this, we didn't actually have a traitor.
We did not.
And we knew this pretty early on.
By the end of the second round, I think we were all just like, somebody would have done something.
Yeah.
So then it was just a straight co-op at that point. And to be honest, again, this goes back to my point before. I kind of felt like it took something out of the game. You know, I felt it was a bit pedestrian because of that. And we were just like, oh, it felt easy as well. You know, we were flying through. So, you know, it really showed me that I do enjoy having that hidden traitor put into these games.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Dead of Winter, without a traitor, I don't want to say it's easy because we won, but just barely, even without a traitor.
Yeah, but I think we were all trying to satisfy our own, you know,
we were goals. Trying to have everyone win.
Right.
Yeah.
Because most of us could have won without any issue. But I think a couple people, I was struggling to meet my win condition. and Spencer was as well, because we both needed two barricades. Barricading is an action. And I didn't realize when I was playing the last round, number one, that it was going to be their last round. I thought we had two more in us to finish the game. So I wasn't as concerned as I should have been. And then I didn't realize the zombies were going to come out before they counted my win condition, which would have knocked out the barricades that I put in place.
Right.
It's like, ah!
But when we beat it, it still felt like beating a co-op. Yes. We all won together and we all helped each other out to win. So, like, that felt cool.
Yeah.
But I think we lost the in-game suspense by not having a hidden traitor.
Even the suspense of it being difficult. Like, Battlestar Galactica felt very difficult. And I was really tense that we were going to lose that game. And there was always the threat of, we can lose at any point. We can basically, you know, run out of...
morale. Food, I think, were the two that were close on.
And the game is over. It's just going to stop before you finish. So that to me had that real tension of like, we can lose this game at any moment. I didn't feel that in Dead of Winter.
Well, that's because we were managing morale. Dead of Winter also has morale. And if morale hits zero in Dead of Winter, you also die. But we were also managing morale very well in that game until the very last round. We were like, okay, we can give up a little bit morale so that we can make sure everyone gets their win condition, which brought us to the break.
Almost killed us.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that bit. You are right. So it does have that mechanic as well, the way you can sort of lose.
So, and we played a quote-unquote short game. I think it still took us like 3.5 hours for five people, but...
It did. Five people, it took, and especially five people with two people who were learning the game for the first time and two people who hadn't played it in a while.
Yep.
All kind of, like, it takes you a while, the first few rounds, to pick up, like... All right, so I do this. Okay, like how, like the mechanics of how a round works took a little bit longer to.
Yeah. And honestly, Dead of Winter has fairly simple mechanics once you understand what's going on there. You have a certain number of actions you can perform. Some of them cost you action points, which are really just dice. And the dice will let you know if you can do a certain action because the number on the die can, for searching and attacking, has to be a certain amount based on your character. There's other things you can use the dice for where it doesn't matter what it is. But yeah, I think that at the beginning, it's kind of overwhelming in all the different things you can do. And as you go later on, you start saying, well, I want more survivors so I can get more actions, which allows you, takes more turns. What I didn't recall from playing, because I hadn't played it for a couple years, what I didn't recall was everyone else kind of just waits while you're taking your turn. So if you're just taking, say you take 2 minutes to take your turn and there's five of us, you're waiting at least 10 minutes before it's your turn again. And 2 minutes is actually fairly quick because you also have the crossroad cards.
Yes. And I was going to point out that the crossroad cards, we read every word of flavor on those cards. I think we could have skimmed a little bit and gotten to the choices because I do think that really slows gameplay down.
Well,
but
like
they're really fun,
too. Yeah, the crossroad cards, again, if you haven't played, usually propose, so there's some kind of text in there that says, if these things are happening, this card qualifies, now read the rest of it. And if you read the rest of it, there's usually two choices that the active player can decide. I'm going to do choice A or choice B. Sometimes there's three, sometimes there's a forced choice. And these cards are pretty dense. It's like it's a page in a book.
They are. And you read the whole thing out loud. But we had so much fun. One of our cards featured Thriller from Michael Jackson. Yep. So we had to put it on while we played because, you know.
Yeah, one of the survivors. Yeah, one of the survivors like, oh, I found this record, and oh, this would be great, and they distracted the zombie for the entire time as long as we paid fuel to keep the record player going.
Yeah.
So, and it really adds a lot of flavor to the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, Dead of Winter, it's fiddly. I think there's more streamlined ways to set that kind of thing up. I do like the system, though. I think, honestly, my biggest thing is just all the little standees for the zombies are cool in theory. In practice, I'm just going to use the little red zombie tokens from now on because I don't need the little stand-up zombies. The zombie tokens would be much faster.
It's also hard to find the survivor you're looking for sometimes. Like, all right, so I drew a new survivor card. I'm going to finish my turn, and then I'm going to spend the rest of everyone else's turns looking through the rest of these survivor guys to find the right person to put on the board.
Yes. Yep. And they all have to match the picture and stuff. So I was talking to Sydney about this, and we're like, well, maybe if we just get colored bases, and then every player gets a color, and then you put your colored base you put your character in the colored base. So at least it's easier to find. Do you have someone in the colony or no? Or do you have someone over there? You can just look at the colored base and,
yeah,
and immediately identify that.
That's a good idea.
I want to get to this because so Terrence and Michael both are not fans of this genre, but I want to read Michael's because I think it's interesting here. He agrees with Terrence on not liking Hidden Traitor. He says, I can enjoy Shadows Over Camelot, which is one I have not played, but I should because it was sort of one of the original Hidden Traitor games. But it's quite rare, and I find it usually he enjoys it when there's no traitor involved. The problem he has is in his group, it ranges from very social people to awkward and shy. He falls somewhere in the middle of this spectrum and usually organizes events because he loves the game, not because he needs to be surrounded by people. With all that said, his main problem is with these types of games is the game. If the game is a co-op, he wants the full experience of working together and not half mishmashed, or can I trust the person I'm working with to help us succeed at our shared goal? And I think that's completely valid. If you want to solve a problem together, these are not your kind of game. It's if you want to have an activity that also encourages you to accuse each other, that's what these games are.
Well, then, and then almost kind of battle each other in a way, because one side is actively making actions and doing things that are going to hamper the other side's progress. And so it does feel like a real like war going on between the two sides, especially towards the end of Battlestar Galactica. It really felt like, you know, those guys are going to beat us unless we do this, this, and this.
Yep.
I feel like it's a really good balance for our player group, especially because we have people like Sydney and Josh who are super into social deduction games, and Chris who likes those, and also people like me who I don't like social deduction games, but I can deal with something as long as there's like strategy I can work with for why I'm making the decisions I am. It's not just pure social. So, you know, it like the strategy draws me in, the actual gameplay, whereas the social deduction part might draw some other people in. It's a really good balance for a gaming group that has both types of players.
I just love how much Spencer loves the game. Like, he
Battlestar Galactica is his favorite game, I think.
I'm telling you, we need to get a stamp made up. Spencer stamp of approval. He's picky.
Yeah. If Spencer likes it, it has to be. Well, it has to be a really specific
subset of games.
If you like the games that Spencer likes, I'll let you know when Spencer likes another game. And we tease him, but he is really open-minded to a lot of different things. But there's not a lot of games he's passionate, like Spades and Battlestar. Like, I think those are the two games where he's like, I love those games.
Yeah. He will always play those.
I do want to talk about a couple others. We're running a little short on time, but we have a little time left. Black Rose. This game is based on a role-playing, like kind of a dark role-playing setting, and Black Rose came out, it's got to be like 5 or 6 years ago. The way that this game works is there's seven, I guess, priests at a rectory? Is that what they
are? A rectory is a word. Go for it.
Sure. And then there's the rector who's in charge, and the rector's corrupt. And two of the priests in this rectory are evil. And the rector knows who they are, but the parent rectory says, uh-oh, something's going on there. We need to send investigators in to find the corrupt priest. The church at large.
Sends two investigators.
Well, they sent a number of investigators equal to the number of players minus the rector. And so we make jokes around other things too, but I'm not going to do it here. So the investigators, of the investigators, as long as there's at least a four-player game, game plays 3 to 5. So if it's 4 or 5 players, of the investigators, one of them will be possessed. All of the investigators want to know who the evil priests are, but the possessed one wants them dead, where everyone else just wants them discovered. Meanwhile, the rector doesn't want his bad people dead because they're working for him. So each time around, you're going to get a little bit of information. And the way the game works is essentially the rector is going to choose 2 cards at the very beginning of the game. And they say innocent on them. They pull it out of the deck. And then all the other 5 innocent cards go in the deck. So as the players are going through, they can find cards that say innocent. And they know this person is not it. At the end of every round, there's only 5 rounds. The investigators will say, is it this person and this person? The rector will say yes or no. If the rector says yes, the investigators win. If the rector says no, then you keep going. If the possessed manages to kill both of them, then the possessed wins. And if the Rector makes it five turns, then they win. There's some other ways, other win conditions and things in there as well, but that's the general gist of it. It's a very fast game. It plays maybe 15, 20 minutes tops. We tend to play four in a row because I usually play at four players, and we tend to play four at a time where everyone gets a chance of being the Rector. Now, you guys played this just once, but what did you think of that game as far as a hidden traitor type of game?
There was a less accusing than normal. It was more like you just played your thing and worked your hardest and, you know, kind of decided who you can trust or not. I don't know. Maybe it was just because me and Sydney pretty much had it figured out that we were good, that it went so smoothly for us.
But I think Sydney was the evil one, right?
I think Sydney was the evil one.
Oh, she was evil?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't even remember this very well.
Right. This is the kind
of
the point.
It played real quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
I think it was a very similar thing to what happened in Battlestar, where she was evil, but she was kind of helping out a little too much because between the two of you, you had guessed the right people. And when you did guess the right people, then she lost. But in her defense, she didn't know who the two evil people were either.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I definitely didn't feel as much attachment, and it might be because of its fast play. The fast play is great if you want a quick game like that, but the problem was I didn't feel any attachment to what was happening. I was kind of didn't really care, you know, I wasn't invested because it was moving so fast. Maybe if I played it a few more times, I'd get more into it, but like Kitty was saying, it didn't feel like there was that same level of mistrust of other people. You were just trying to puzzle it out, and you knew that someone was against you, but you weren't really thinking about it too much. I kind of liked it in Battlestar Galactica when we were all pointing the fingers and we were throwing people in the brig who weren't even evil.
We threw so many people in the brig.
Right. Who weren't even evil.
Three out of five players were in the brig at the end of the game.
To be fair, it was some Cylons were doing some brig throwing most of the time. But
we did get a Cylon in the brig, though.
We did.
That's true.
Finally.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring up Black Rose because I have played it quite a bit, and it is a hidden traitor game, but I do agree with you. It's so short that unless you play multiple times, you don't get that same feeling.
I feel like even if you're playing it many times in a row, you don't, like, you have to be real certain to, like, throw out the accusations at all. Mostly you just want to play your strategy and, you know, do what you need to do, and then, you know, there's just like one moment there where you have to kind of decide who you trust, who you don't, and general consensus usually comes to, you know, an okay answer. Yeah.
So here's the question. Does the hidden traitor mechanic, so almost always this hidden traitor mechanic is going to be put on top of a co-op game, or in the case of Black Rose, like a one versus many or something like that. Does the hidden traitor mechanic stop alpha player in those particular kinds of games? I mean, we'll talk Dead of Winter and Battlestar Galactica to start with.
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, the alpha player can become the suddenly be on the evil side. So it certainly can stop the alpha player by taking them onto a different side of the game from the good guys, I guess. I don't think I've played enough to really know. It didn't feel like anyone was alphaing.
If the alpha player is the hidden traitor, they can just, like, torpedo the game.
But the idea of having a hidden traitor is that nobody really can be the alpha player, take control of everything, because everyone's going to be suspicious of that person, right?
Maybe.
So I think Battlestar Galactica, it works really well because you always know there will be a traitor at some point. Dead of Winter, you might think, oh, this player's really helpful. They're trying to do what's best for everyone. They know the game better than I do. I'm going to listen to them, especially if they're teaching you the game. Maybe this happened to me. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, and I win and you guys all lose. And it's just like devastating. So I don't know. You have to have, I think, a few strong players to really make sure that not the hidden traitor isn't just like getting away with it.
Right. I think you were able, because you were able, I think, to convince Spencer that I was evil. And, you know, sometimes the game mechanics help with that because, you know, certain choices look very bad.
But I think you guys are kind of putting alpha players and strong players in the same group.
That might be true.
Whereas you're right if you're talking about strong players. Like, I think this we should do this or this or this. Versus the alpha player, which is basically just playing the game for the group.
That's true. And I don't think that happens. Yeah, especially because it suddenly becomes kind of one side versus the other side.
I think Battlestar Galactica definitely solves the alpha player problem. I don't know that Dead of Winter does.
Yeah.
Because it does feel more cooperative, even if it's not really. And I know maybe it's just the way that I've played both times. It felt very co-op-y, like we worked together. And it's because one time there was like, I'm not going to necessarily say definite alpha player, but very strong player who knew the game better than everyone else, who's, you know, giving all this really like, you should do this, you should be doing this with your card, you know, like very helpful advice, but they were the traitor and it was not helpful. It was terrible advice. So, yeah.
So, I'm going to go back to my Grand Con story with Tom Vassell because I want to talk about what other game. And I agree with you guys. I think any hidden information can help stem the alpha player problem. If there's not enough hidden information, though, you could still have an alpha player. And the hidden traitor by itself may not be enough to stem that. But different goals, I think, will start to do it. So Sydney and I just got done playing Sector 6. Tom came over and asked us if we wanted to play a game that he was, you know, just had received and was, you know, looking for people to play. So there was a 7 people and we were playing this game called Among Us, which is a game that's released. It's on BGG. It actually has a decent, well, it's not decent, but it has a rating of, actually, no, I take it back. I was thinking of another one. This game does not have a rating on it. It's interesting.
That feels like a lukewarm review.
Yeah. Well, actually, now that I'm looking at it, it doesn't look like this. It may not be released. Maybe this was just an early copy. But the way the game worked was you were agents inside of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and there were aliens that were coming down. And the aliens were attacking these different areas of, there's 5 different regions in Washington, D.C. And then you had 5 scientists. So you needed to get the agents to get the scientists to the Capitol and escape them. And once you had all the scientists escaped, then you win the game. There was a stack of probably 80 little mini cards. And in that 80 cards is 4 alien cards. Now, they're dealt in 4 different piles, 4 different stacks. And at the very beginning of the game, everyone gets 1 of these cards. So it's really, really low odds that you're going to be an alien at that point. But every time you do something with the agents, you have to draw a card. So over time, you could potentially become an alien. Now, you could do other things. There was event cards that you could draw. And you could draw 2 and put 1 at the bottom and 1 at the top of the deck. So you can kind of, you know, filter the bad cards to the bottom. But if you're an alien, you could do that and say, I'm going to filter the bad cards to the top. So it felt a little pandemic-y in how the aliens spread over the things. The agents could get rid of aliens or they could move the scientists, mm-hmm. but you had to be, there's these road colors and you had to be at the right color road and then you could take from one agent to another agent.
Very fiddly.
It was not streamlined. There was a lot going on. And in the end, by the time you're, and there's this crisis die that keeps going up too, or crisis count that can go up each time a new mothership comes in. Now, every time I do something with the agents, I draw 2 cards and then 3 cards and 4 cards. At the end of the game, you're drawing like 4 or 5 cards every time you do an action with the agents. So if you're not an alien, you're going to turn into one eventually. Like I turned into an alien the very last turn. I didn't do anything. The aliens won. I won just because I happened to have drawn the alien card. So it wasn't very a satisfactory win. I did find it interesting. However, when I was looking at this as far as a hidden role is concerned, when it was my turn, there was a lot of discussion about what we should do. But ultimately, I was the one in control and I was the one that would be able to do whatever. And if I could justify what I did as a viable thing and there was enough different things to do.
Yeah.
People were like, okay, I guess that makes sense, you know. And there was a couple times where he backed someone into a corner saying, I'm going to move here and you should do this. And if you don't, I know you're an alien. So we did that a couple times, which was kind of fun. Again, it's like this hidden information to allow someone to take their turn without the group taking their turn for them. It wasn't a good game. It had potential. It wasn't well developed.
Did it seem to have I don't know if you've described anything like this, like a send to the brig or a exile from the group kind of mechanic.
Yes.
If you found out.
Okay. Actually, good point. Good point. Everyone got a little wooden finger and you could accuse someone of being an alien. Say, Josh, I think you're an alien. And he would take his stack of little alien cards. And as long as someone else seconded, and he'd start flipping the cards one at a time until an alien showed up or he was out of cards. If he got out of cards and the two people that accused him lost their right to accuse in the future, if an alien came up, then he was outed as an alien, but you wouldn't see the rest of the cards. So you wouldn't know if he had two or three alien cards, if there are any more aliens in the group.
Okay.
Once you're outed as an alien, your actions are limited to manipulating the event deck or adding new UFOs around where agents are. So there was also that accusation mechanic. There was a lot going on in this game.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So that game is Among Us. Like I say, I don't know if it's released yet. It definitely has potential. I think with a little bit more work, it could be something that's kind of fun. But right now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, we got invited to play a Hidden Traitor game a couple days before we were doing the podcast. So I just wanted to kind of mention it as one of those games.
Excellent timing.
Yes. All right. We are always going long. Anything else to add?
I don't think so.
I think... wait, one more question. Is there a trend we want to see more of? I absolutely love Hidden Traitor games and I want to see more of them personally. But
me too. Couldn't agree more.
Meh.
All right. So two yeses and a meh. We'll take it. All right. New iTunes reviews. We got like three in the last week and a half or so. So Apex 11111. Thank you. Hal Jordan 6-9. Maybe Hal Jordan 3. Or negative 3? No. Hal Jordan 6-9. And Stand Sure Games. You guys all said really, really nice things. So thank you for leaving us an iTunes review. Anyone, if you want to leave us an iTunes review, it's greatly appreciated.
We'd love you for it.
We love it. I'm always checking in like, oh man, look at this nice review. Usually people are just saying nice things about Kitty. So
I love it.
Let's see, you can follow us on Twitter at Tabletop Game Talk, Tabletop Game TLK, Facebook at @TabletopGameTalkPodcast, Instagram at Tabletop Game Talk. You can follow me on Twitter at Game Master Chris. And if you want to be a patron, you get to be entered for automatically in all of our giveaways. You can get more information on that at TabletopGameTalk.com/Patreon, PATREON. And with that, Josh, why don't you take us out?
Indeed. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review or email us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Finally, a huge thank you to all of our patrons, Emil Jiljam, George, Adam Harrison, Sam from New York, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Alex Brown, Michael Arl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, John Merkel, Daniel Shepard, C. Marie, Rudy Rudy Lou, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Michael Smith, Stefan Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, John Lewis, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Carl Hammond, David Radke, and Lance Morgan. Until next week, when we talk about classic games, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. I typed it about 4 seconds before you had to name next week's topic.
Otherwise, I would have done what we usually do, which is just read the same name again.
So now we have to talk about Monopoly and Risk, and we have to throw the Game of Life in there.
Yahtzee.
And Yahtzee, oh God.